A story is a way to say something that can't be said any other way, and it takes every word in the story to say what the meaning is. Flannery O'Connor. A fictional adventure told in 100 episodes.
Once upon a time, in the beginning.
Solve the World, episode 100. Until I'm made new, the toilet will keep running. The classroom. Jen sits at a small table. She's a bit oversized for it, as her knobby knees scratch the bottom of the desk in front of her. She's never been to school until now, so this first for her does not go by unnoticed. She stares at the walker. He is standing, glasses on, fitted in a suit and tie, holding a piece of chalk in his hand. He turns away from Jen and scribbles three words on the blackboard with his poor chicken-scratch penmanship. Jen reads the three words aloud as they appear. Love. Justice. Hope. In the beginning, I begin. Upon deciding that I was going to create, I wanted to form a universe that was indwelt with these three principles. Love, justice, and hope. I wanted every creature to either internally, intuitively live by these principles, or for the more advanced species, such as yourself, humans, and humanoids, I wanted them to have an express appreciation and understanding of these principles' properties. So, let's start with love, shall we? That's maybe the most difficult term to define of the three. In English, in particular, the word covers such a range of emotions and procedures that it's almost to the point of being useless. The Greeks had four words for love. There was storge, which was a familial type of love. Often it carries with it a sense of acceptance, almost begrudging, like, of course I love you, you're my sister. Or something like the phrase, blood is thicker than water. That sort of thing. Storge is also obviously where we get our word for, you know, stork. And the stork brings us our babies, our family. Familial love, storge, stork. See how that works? Then there's Eros. That one's easy. Intense, burning, romantic love. But it's more akin to infatuation or lust, even, than anything virtuous. Phileo love is brotherly love. Hence why the American city Philadelphia is considered the city of brotherly love. Aristotle brought it into common use when he used it to define friendship. This is love that's based on mutual respect and general equality. The type of love I wanted for humanity was phileo love in the abstract. I wanted every man and woman to look around them and feel a sense of gratitude and respect for the creatures that co-inhabit the earth. That seems like a good thing to build an empire upon, right? Your generation understands this better than most before it. Acceptance, tolerance, inclusivity. Generally speaking, this is good for us to have. Phileo love is good. All of us together phileo loving toward our as of yet unknown brothers and sisters. That's good. But it doesn't reach far enough. Tolerance, endurance, respect, equanimity towards all is great. It's a good start. But it doesn't quite get the job done. The other Greek word for love is agape. Often, it was used to describe the relationship between the gods and man, a sort of dissociated love. But I like what the philosopher Thomas Aquinas did to the word. He called agape love to will the good of another. 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 nothing to will the good of another. It's self-sacrificing love. It's giving up something of personal value. That's how this world should spin when we talk face to face. It might be hard for you to sit and hear my story. Your inclination will always be to not listen, to trumpet your own story. I say my dog tripped and bumped his head. You don't really listen to that. You just hear that we're talking about tripping. And so you naturally want to one-up me by telling me about your last vacation when you bonked your head on the side of the Orion. It's hard to resist that urge to not hear the subtext. I'm worried about my dog. My world doesn't revolve around relationships with other people. See, in my little story, there's warning signs. Resisting the urge to make it about your feats of grandeur, your own creativity, your humor, that's self-sacrifice. That's agape love. It also means there are times when tolerance and acceptance don't work. True love is honest and seeks the best. The best is hard. Sometimes the best is really hard to hear. Sometimes you need to tell me that I drink too much, even when I don't want to hear that. Even when my day at work or at school was hard and the only way to relax is to open up another bottle. It's self-sacrificing to enter into that covenant of truth and trust. Because it's dangerous. I might hate you. I might hate you, Jennifer Dash, if you stare too closely at my warts. I might. That's always gonna be there. So there's always risk. That's what I wanted for this world. That's what I wanted it to be. Now,
The Expanse.
With those three principles, just imagine how we got here.
Jen and the Walker are floating in space, in a dark, never-ending void. Below them, though, is a long, 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 long rectangle. The rectangle itself is also dark, but it has corners. It's like a giant two-dimensional board floating in the vast nothing of interspace.
Imagine robots, if you will. A whole dimension full of pre-programmed robots.
Suddenly, out of nothing, tens, twenties, hundreds, and thousands of silver-looking android robots pop up out of nothing and walk mechanically about their board. They're your classic 1950s-era lo-fi futuristic robots, machines that could have been swiped right out of the classic TV show Lost in Space.
Imagine millions of worker bees, all programmed to respond to data and exhibit the three most important principles. Love, justice, hope. But you want them to be adaptable. After all, the Earth is made up of different things. There's mountains, there's rivers, there's lakes, there's trees, there's bugs, there's worms, there's lions. So, rather than having all the robots know exactly the same thing and do the same thing their whole life, you give the robots a certain function. The ability to learn to adapt. That's the trick, right there. Right from the beginning, learning is the key to all our profit and all our misery. Every robot out there learns different things, simply based on where they are on the board, on the Earth, when they began, or rather, when they were born, and, perhaps most importantly, who they meet along the way. Let's say one robot learns how to make fire because he saw lightning strike a tree. He now shares that information with those with whom he's in contact with. Eventually, because truth, once explored, can do no other but become known everywhere, eventually all robots will learn how to make fire. But they'll learn at different times and at different seasons. See, it's not just about what information you learn, but when you learn it. And in what order? If I'm taught Hinduism when I'm 2 years old, that's gonna mean something different to me than, say, Islam, which perhaps I learn at 12 years old. The order of information accumulation is vitally important. Robots and humans alike naturally build from a base, and the base carries all the weight. You see then, in this way, although every single robot starts the same, with a blank slate, tabula rasa, they become unique simply based on their experiences. There is no limit to their uniqueness. Every small thing, every chance encounter, creates a new little lesson, a new little something in their memory banks. Whether we are cognizant of it or not, we are always learning, always curating. Then we rate our moments, prize them in a prism of contextuality. These robots, just like you, Jen, were plopped into reality without knowing what reality is. Who's its master? What's it for? What it must do?
Jen watches a particular robot which seems to have carved itself a little hole in the ground and sits on bended knees, hands clasped to one another. Its robotic googly eyes lift up to the heavens, past the limits of its two-dimensional kingdom. It's obvious to Jen. The robot is praying.
Add a natural end to the robot existence. Death. The first death. And you've naturally got a much more complicated system arising. There's an infinite amount of moments in every single day. Did you know that? Every day is a world of knowledge without end unto itself. In this way, even a world of robots is one in which infinity meets infinity. Infinity, Jen, can never be outmatched. Not by any other infinity.
The morgue.
Examine this dead one.
Jen and the walker stand over an examination table, both decked out in doctoral scrubs. The walker, Dr. Walker, has a scalpel in his hand. He brings it to the steely cylinder cage that makes up the robot's chest. He begins to cut it open, revealing a bevy of cords, wires, and microchips.
The thing is, we're not robots. This here is this robot's motherboard. You can see the design is intricate.
From the exact opposite side of the chest, Dr. Walker pulls out another board.
This is the father board. At first it looks identical, but it isn't. It's its own set of instructions. A system for learning. A system for prioritizing, for curating, for interpretation and design. Humans get two sets of chromosomes. One from mother, one from father. You see, we're not robots. We're perfect clones. All those thoughts of mother, those experiences of father, don't fool yourself. It's all in there. Everything. Somehow, everything gets passed on. And the child learns to make these two wholes into two halves of one whole. He bridges the two worlds, and through his own independent, infinitely distinctive learning experiences, finds a new infinity. His own.
The chessboard. Jen and Walker sit on rocks on a beach. In front of them is a chessboard. A chessboard made up of the previous black rectangular expanse, now made small. The robots are the chess pieces.
I made the robots, Jen. And I made them just like me. I made you all in my image. But what if there's a bad apple? Or an unfortunate set of circumstances? Tragedy can strike, right? As long as the robots are in a state of flux, in a now but not yet way of being, there will be accidents. If you're learning, then there's stuff you don't know. And trust me, whatever you don't know hurts you.
Walker, sitting at the chess table facing Jen, holds a scythe in his hand. He's dressed in all black with a heavy hooded sweatshirt covering his head. With a wave of his scythe over the board, all the robots fall to pieces. Broken. Instinctively, Jen grabs at the board, trying desperately to put the little figurines back together. She's thinking of the little praying robot. Even if this is a simulation, it still feels wrong. Unjust.
So then you see, once it's broken, you can't put it back together. What's broken stays broken. This is born of the fact that all moments matter. Everything that comes in stays in. No matter the good, no matter the bad, your body processes everything you eat. In the same way, your soul processes everything you experience. Everything.
The computer. Jen finds herself standing in a cavernous, underground, windowless bunker of never-ending fans and computers. Walker stands beside her.
I made the robots, so I know all possibilities. I know all their ways. In a way, I'm like this computer here.
He places a loving hand on the tall bank of processors.
I'm like a computer with every possible variable memorized. But there are more than merely infinite variables. There's the infinite meeting the infinite, constantly, eternally. I am but one computer designed to comprehend but one set of infinite variables. My infinity, you see, is still endless, but it is a lesser endless than that of the robots who learn. In this way, then, you must realize there are answers and choices and results and conclusions that I simply cannot predict or expect.
The classroom.
That's why the three words are so foundational. Maybe they can stave off the breaking. Maybe, if you hope, goodness will always prevail. Forced to look at the spectrum, the kaleidoscope of infinities crashing into infinities, you realize that the likelihood of breaking, of the good not prevailing, is impossible to calculate. Risk is born, and it's been with us ever since. So this is the point when you make the hard decision. The ultimate decision. You decide to intervene. You say, I'll walk with man. I'll show him the riches of love, justice, and hope. I'll seal the universe, envelope it in my masterful assurance. I'll explain love until it has form. I'll describe justice until it takes literal shape. I'll express hope until it rubs off on the identity of every soul. You do it. You walk with man. I am he whom you see in front of you now.
The globe. Here, a globe of Earth and nothing else. It spins amidst a great nothingness. Jen watches as it turns from an extravagant green and blue to a washed out brown and gray.
What you didn't perceive comes about. To teach the principles, love, justice, hope, is to bring about, at first in the imagination, but it doesn't stay there long, their antitheticals, hate, injustice, and despair. The more I preached goodness, the more evil had to become known. It's a fact of life. We can't help but define every idea by its opposite. We know hunger only because we know full. We know the contours of joy only because we've also seen the face of depression. The more I taught Adam about love, the more rigid and solid hate became as a potentiality. The sad truth is, all potentials come to the surface. They find ways to manifest themselves.
In the midst of the gray ocean on the globe, there's a magnificent tremor, and then a great water spout. It's a monster arising from the depths.
The more I show up, the more I intervene, the more external these things become. This is essential. You must understand this. When I walked and described love to Adam, love was no longer intuitive, instinctive, something ill-defined, but yet real. No. It became an ideal, something apart from Adam and apart from me. It was something to live up to. The same went for justice and hope. They became externals, something to earn, to live up to be sanctioned with after much effort. Like the final scene in the original Star Wars, love, justice, and hope were medals to be won, earned by service rendered. When that clicks, when that turn comes, paganism begins. Man worships what will bring him the ideals. The ideals become things to envy, things to desire and covet. And if, by perception or reality, one falls short, that's when. That's the unholy moment when the antitheticals become great seducers. Hate, injustice, despair. They don't compare, right? They are shadows next to their opposites. And yet, person after person take up those mantles. Hate, injustice, despair. Because they believe that they, at least these perverse reflections, are at least obtainable. Those are medals that can actually be won. And it's better to have some medal, even if it's bad, than no medal at all. So after Adam fell from grace and I saw the beginning of what was to come, I made a second decision. No longer would I intervene as myself, but now, in order to maintain the three principles, but to try to reorient humanity back to thinking of love and justice and hope as internals, not prizes to be won, something in you, a part of you, in order to do that, I split myself into three beings. Behemoth was love, Ziz, hope, and Leviathan, justice. Behemoth, as I believe you well know, was hunted from the beginning.
Across the brown Serengeti of the globe, Jen watches an oversized land monster, like a rhino on steroids, plod over the land, over the globe. Spears and javelins spring up and spray out at the enormous beast.
He was killed in the name of truth. But this was not truth. When he died, so did my heart. For I am he.
The warehouse. The walker sits on the floor, his back resting against a white wall. He's dressed in a nice suit. He wears a charming fedora. It's some sort of scene out of the 1940s. But he's holding his stomach, and there's blood seeping out, dark red. He's been shot in the gut. His hands are covered with blood. His mouth, too, spits out the marrow of life as he speaks. A dying Don Juan Al Capone in some tragic mafia flick.
I died that day, don't you see? When George slayed me, love was killed. I have been killed by my own children. Can you fathom it? No, I don't think you can. To be ruined by your own beloved. Behemoth guarded creation and lived as a testament to goodness, to renewal. He was a sign to all creation that not all things die. The honest brutality of nature is but a singular level in a grand game. Behemoth, I am. So as to show a deeper reality. A reality rejected and despised, killed and humiliated. Skinned and mounted as a prize. Love became a prize to be won. And was forever impugned, forever sickened, forever perversed.
The globe. A shadow floats above the waters. The source is a great eagle. Wings outstretched from tail to tail, the size of India.
Ziz, I was. And as Ziz, I discovered I was best suited as a past and future creature. Justice and love demand immediacy, nowness. Hope thrives not on this, but on the gone and the near. Hope is never manifest in the present. Therefore, in the beginning years, the rumor was properly cultivated that Ziz would one day come. He was a future foretold. An expectation. Hope, in this way, springs eternal, and eternity is always a step ahead. Likewise, after Behemoth's slaying, the narrative needed to switch. It was time for that which was ahead to become a great lost past. something like Atlantis. So, Ziz went through a door, took some with her. Ziz went to a better place. That is how hope stayed real for the people of Earth. She became a being of the glorious past. Leviathan is justice. That is why I've waited so long. Justice is strong and right and harsh, unmerciful. Until injustice was so severe on the Earth that justice couldn't wait any longer. Leviathan was made for the last moment. That is why she eats up the world. To make justice reign, the world must pay for her many sins.
The great monster of the seas rises up from the waters. A second ago, a submersive creature now plants herself on the surface of the waters itself. She takes flight, flying now the true dragon of the end. She breathes fire. The waters recede to nothing, boiled away. The grasses of the earth are quenched in flame. The world becomes as nothing. All the while, the dragon flies, seemingly growing with every flap of its featherless wings. Until at last, the globe is a charred ball, the dragon many times larger than it, and, at the very last moment, it swallows the entire burnt remains. The whole ball of Earth. The whole of history, already forgotten. The classroom.
This, my dear Jen Dash, is the history of the world.
A pause remains in the classroom as the teacher waits patiently for the student to inquire. There's music playing. What's that song? The professor points to a stereo player in the corner of the room.
That's my wife singing.
You have a wife? How's that possible?
I do. She's lovely. One of the main reasons I have hope.
Why's that?
She's an unjust reward. She's infused my life with meaning and joy that I thought not possible for a schmuck like me.
They listen to the music for a moment.
But what is left as of yet unsaid?
Professor Walker says a bit sheepishly, perhaps uncertain of himself.
Is how you fit into all this madness. What position does the magnanimous Jen Dash play?
He turns to the chalkboard, writes the phrase, infinity meets infinity, circles it, and turns his gaze back on his pupil.
I mentioned before that what we called robots are functioned off of two basic infinities. One infinity is experience. The other is the memories laced up in genetics of your forefathers and foremothers. In this way, you must see now why you're unique, no?
He expected some sort of answer, a nod or a raise of the eyebrow. Something. Anything that connoted understanding. Jennifer Dash offers nothing. The Grand Canyon. Jen's never been to the Grand Canyon, but here she is. The Grand Canyon, or something very much like it. Deep red and brown towers abound on either side of this great crevice. Except, there's no Colorado River here. There's only sand and some small shrubberies. Jen looks up. The sun is far, far, far ahead in the sky, but the looming earthen towers boom nearly as large, like natural skyscrapers. A shiver runs down her spine as the glass house makes a passing reference in her memory. Jen walks beside me, as I explain.
Tarzan and Mowgli from the Jungle Book, heck, Romulus and Remus who founded Rome, all incredible stories. Each hold a secret answer to why their protagonist is incredible, invincible to the snares of the modern man. They are all raised by others. They are children of the animal kingdom. They somehow missed the second infinity of humanity. They are mere robots built on the singular infinity of genetics. Other myths, mostly those of early religion, golems and various gods, are stories built the other way. Heroes who are not born of man, and therefore are blueprints only of experience. experience being the only infinity they have. It's the age-old nature versus nurture. It's a constant peril to both man and myth. But the ugly truth is this. There are no gods, no heroes who circumvent the human genome. That myth died with the Enlightenment. But the wild child endured. Tarzan. A man not raised by humans. The perfect tabula rasa. The clean slate. It's funny. There are scores of real examples of such people. But nature is cruel. None of the wild children could ever take up their humanity after being raised in the wilderness alone. In actuality, Tarzan doesn't work. The synapses harden, petrify. Language, to the wild children, language remained forever beyond them. Love, justice, and hope were forever things beyond their grasp. The myth was dead in their embodiment.
I smile.
But then you came along. Sure, you're not a pure specimen. You had the occasional interaction with your mother. She fed you. And of course you had the warming glow of the television, and thank God for it. That allowed you to obtain language. Otherwise, you would have suffered the same fate as the wild children, gone too far into your primal self. That, though, wasn't to be your fate. And so when you decided to leave your home at long last, to leave Louisiana and make haste towards ultimate knowledge, the rest of humanity, whether it be the first person who wanted to pick you up in his big rig, Johnny Paxwell, do you remember him? Or moments later, Dolores Burden, or the Patriot, or Tiff, or even Mom and Father Beck, all of them sensed that you were different. You were not infinity meeting infinity. You were simple infinity. And so you could be the anthem of humanity. You embodied the ultimate human experience. That's why you became famous, why everyone who ever met you was attracted to you, why somehow you became the center of the world's story. And it worked both ways. Because you were naturally a simple infinity and not an infinity meeting infinity, many of those people who were attracted to you thought they could use you, thought they could claim you. You see? This is how your story came to be.
No, Jen answered. The closet. We're back in Jen's closet, scrunched up. The light of the TV illuminates our faces.
It's true,
I say. No, it's not.
I promise you, it is.
Jen takes a big breath. It may be true, but it's not the important truth. It's not, the relevant truth.
How so?
You haven't really told me why bad things happen.
That's exactly what I've done. I've just spent a luxurious amount of precious time explaining it all to you. All the major highlights. Why are you resisting the truth, Jen Dash?
Because my experience begs to differ.
Tell me more about that.
Okay. My experience has taught me the truth. When it comes from another person, when it truly is true, and not some truth that's being exploited for some reason or another. Like, the difference between the truths that Miles Faw told me and the ones that Father Thomas taught is that when you speak the truth, you're always a little scared.
Scared?
I echo. Yeah. The truth is scary because it's always vulnerable. It's like a sword. You can do good things with it, or it can be used against you.
You can fall on your own sword.
That's what makes it scary.
But I'm God, Jen. There's nothing past me. There's nothing for me to be worried about, scared of. You can't scare me.
Jen sighs, gathering her thoughts. If my thoughts are your thoughts, as you say, then you need to shut up for a moment and listen to my case. You haven't given me a real answer yet. There's only one question. I know that now. I've suddenly fallen on it. There's only one question. There's only one question whose answer solves the world. The Grand Canyon.
What question is that?
Why do bad things happen?
That's it?
Yeah.
That's not very profound.
It doesn't have to be. The canyon walls shake. Fragments of rocky earth begin cracking and tumbling thousands of feet. Splintered rocks fall behind us and ahead. The courtroom. I'm on the witness stand. Jen's interrogating me.
You want the truth? You can't handle the truth!
Why do bad things happen? One sentence. Come on. Give it to me.
Nah, you don't want this.
I demand this.
You don't need this.
I do. Go! Go! The Gladiator Arena. Jen finds herself swirling around in the middle of a Roman arena. There's chanting coming from a crowd. She tries to look at the faces, make out the individuals watching her, but they're all hazy, like the fog surrounding the ladders. It's in them, through them, the gray. Why can't she see them? Who are they?
Are you not entertained?
I whisper to Jen. I'm standing beside her, sword in my hand. She has one too. She wonders, are our swords meant for each other? Or someone else? I won't be distracted. Answer my question. Give me this one sentence. One answer. Give me what I want and I'll go away.
I gave you life.
I climbed your ladder. I came to you.
Because I wanted you to.
Maybe. But I still deserve an answer. The accounting office. A typewriter and a calculator lay in front of Jen. She sits at a desk. One desk amidst a sea of organized rows. This large coliseum-sized office is filled to the brim with the clattering of typewriters as a thousand businessmen sit, hunched over, checking and pounding their numbers. From behind, I lean over Jen's shoulder. I push a paper in front of her eyes.
Now, you see, you don't deserve an answer. The creature does not deserve anything from the creator. I've made this tally sheet for you to analyze. As you can see on the left are the expenses and luxuries I've doled out as your overwatcher and manager. You'll see the final number at the bottom of the page is quite large. Here, on the right-hand side, you'll see the column of fundamentals that you've doled out for me. If this number down here, right here, at the bottom of your side, exceeded my number, then of course I'd be in your debt. It'd be understandable for you to claim reparations of some sort. But as you can see, your number is so very slight. There is nothing you deserve from me, my dear.
Why do bad things happen? She repeats. The Gladiator Arena.
Bad things happen because I need them to!
The gallows. I stand on a wooden stool, a noose tightly drawn around my neck.
Because without the bad things, you don't exist.
I slip on the stool and begin choking, my esophagus collapsing in. Jen grabs me, lunging two arms around my legs. She tightens her grip and holds me up to stop me from asphyxiating. Why are you putting me through this charade?
Are you not entertained?
The Painted Forest. We're walking for a time, stride in stride, before one of us finally breaks the silence. You said you had a choice for me to make.
That's true.
I mutter. Well, what is it?
You've moved on already?
There's nothing else to do. I expected as much.
How?
There's no logical answer besides the one you gave me. You made the world out of boredom. I get it. We're the best soap opera there ever could be. We were made to quench your boredom.
Why is that the most logical answer?
Because if you exist, a god, creator, king, and you have ultimate, unlimited power, which clearly you do, Jen holds up her restored hand as testimony to my many wonders, then like I said before, you can't be good.
That breaks my heart to hear.
But, having met you now, I can see that you're not evil. At least, you don't want to be evil. You're just like Miles or the Piper. You all just make these decisions that you probably explain away, like, it's better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. You use all these pointless idioms and philosophies, explanations, to allow the world to torment. Because you needed to get your jollies off somehow. By the way, that little stunt you just pulled off, showing me the accounting numbers, you're cooking the books, man.
No, I'm not. I'm not evil, either.
Then why'd you do it?
I didn't want you to know, because this truth, this relevant, most real truth for you, can't be the final answer. I can't bear it to be so.
The theater. I start my soliloquy.
Theater of Remembrance, come take this chance. Hear what will be heard. Quiver not at fates foretold. Once upon a lifetime, is there any truth in rhyme? Can we find a way to absolution, even though there's no logical solution? Can we find our catharsis, something to leave us breathless? For if we shadows have offended, think on this and all is mended, that there is more and less to the world than that which has yet unfurled. Think not, love not, logic not, fret not, strive not, feel not. Live and let live, and inevitably die and let die. For you moan for no reason. This is not the season of our discontent, or of our great...
Stop! The lights turn off. The darkness. Here, wherever here is, I can't see anything. Neither can Jen. Don't make a spectacle. Just tell me what you need to tell me. The living room. There's a TV, flicks through channel after channel. It illuminates the room with flashes of white, red, green, blues, all the stories of a generation, trapped in a box, flashing and flashing by. I sit on the edge of my couch, paying no heed to the television. Instead, I'm hunched over, scribbling the last lines on a piece of paper. I don't bother to read it over. I just hand the paper up to Jen, who stands above me.
Read it aloud,
I say. 50 people whom I pity, Jen reads. Number 50, the storyteller. Of all the harmful professions in the world, is there any so generationally damaging as the clod who makes his living as a professional liar? He spins yarns, creates false universes, so as to veil his own faults. He describes others because he can't describe himself. He makes a world because his own is beyond his own comprehension. If he were a moral creature, he'd admit that he's at a loss. He'd struggle not to escape reality, but rather define the contours of his own understanding. Instead, he hides and pities himself a poet. You are no poet, vain man, insect who has no taste for the sheer bigness of absoluteness. Read your own words, eat your own verbal vomit. Just as a dog returns to her own waste, you need only to reflect upon the havoc you've caused to enumerate the brokenness of your cowardly stunts. Read your words and weep. you are no closer to understanding, no closer to warding off death and the great unknown. What is this? Jen asks.
Keep reading.
No.
Keep reading.
You say you hope beyond hope, but then why do you fear so? You are a doubting Thomas, but doubting Thomas himself never knew he was such, until the Christ pointed it out. At least he was ignorant of his transgression. You, unlike him, can make no claim. You are not ignorant. You are woeful and fully aware of your hypocrisy. Jen skims through the essay before reading the final lines aloud. Remember, remember, if there is any justice in this world, if there is any great arbiter at the end of days, then the storyteller should be the first to hang for his crimes against humanity, for he's murdered millions in his mind. Is this supposed to be you?
Yes.
You're flogging yourself.
Yes.
Why?
Because I need you so badly to understand, but I don't know if I can prove it to you.
But your thoughts are my thoughts.
I know.
So you don't know if you believe it yourself. The Gladiator Arena. I drop my sword.
Look at the crowd.
Jen spins around as she takes in the immense Colosseum with all its roving inhabitants.
Can you make out their faces?
No, they're all fuzzy.
They are real.
Who are they?
They're... like me.
Gods?
Yeah.
So, they create too.
Remember when you were on that rescue boat?
The poop deck. Waves crash against the hull of the ship. There's a helicopter in the distance coming towards us. Jen knows the helicopter, knows who's in it. Joanna de Tocqueville, another boss that used Jen to extract what she wanted. I'm standing beside Jen as we get wet from the splashing and the misting tumultuous weather.
Remember the drawing you made?
It was of my dream. Except, instead of someone else, I drew myself. It was me. I was climbing. Trying to get to the king that lived on the top of the mountain. The one that everyone in the valley feared. I'm trying to get there, but I keep falling down the mountain. I get up, climb, and fall back down.
Sisyphus.
What?
You were imagining a version of Sisyphus.
I don't know what that is. What are you saying exactly?
Sisyphus, in Greek mythology, was a king who thought himself more clever than Zeus. So, Zeus punished him by making him push a boulder up a mountain. His torment would end whenever he could just get the boulder all the way to the top of the mountain. But Zeus made sure that before Sisyphus crested the summit, the boulder slipped out of his hands, tumbling to the mountain base. Sisyphus is caught in a never-ending struggle. It's a thinly veiled metaphor. We strive for perfection, to overcome our demons, but we never quite can. We think we can achieve something, reach a new height. But as soon as we do, we realize the mountain's taller than we realized. There's always another shelf, another ridge yet higher. The game never ends. But Sisyphus isn't the point.
What is? The mountain. Jen is climbing a mountain. It is the mountain of her dreams. I am not there. I can't be. In this metaphor, I'm the king at the top, the judge, the ruler. Jen hears my voice, though, echoing off the mountainsides. She's climbing desperately, using every fiber of muscles to gallop up the pass.
That drawing.
It's real, Jen.
It's real, Jen.
You made it. You made it.
You were its creator.
You were its creator. You were its creator.
So?
Its creature,
the
little version of you on that
paper,
is caught.
She's stuck in that world. stuck on that paper,
stuck on that paper,
and shall always be falling down the mountain, down the mountain, down the mountain, down the mountain.
A rock slips under Jen's foot. She loses her balance and falls, tumbling down the hill. With a bloodied hand, she catches herself by clawing onto a jutting piece of earth. Frustrated but committed, she pushes herself up onto her feet. 100 feet lower than she started, Jen begins again. She climbs. That's madness. It was just a drawing.
Every thought is real,
Jen. Thought is real, thought is real, thought is real.
No, thoughts are thoughts. They're the opposite of real.
Everything you think.
Everything you think.
Everything.
Everything. Everything.
You
think.
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 Has an electrical
has
charge.
Has charge. Charge.
Neurons are being
neurons
made.
Are
gluons
made.
Are connecting
gluons
tissues
are connecting
and forming
tissues
physical
and
connections
in your brain.
In your
brain.
That's real.
That's real. That's real.
Every thought has a
every
real concrete foundation.
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 Okay, but it's just electricity or whatever. Like, a piece of metal is real, but it alone isn't a building. It's just like a building block.
Nice try.
Nice try. Nice try. Nice
remember
try.
What Einstein discovered?
Einstein discovered. Einstein discovered. Einstein discovered. Einstein discovered.
I don't know. Jen is annoyed. She's focused on climbing, not philosophizing.
E equals mc squared. Energy,
energy, energy
equals mass
equals
times
mass
the speed
times
of light squared.
Light squared. Light squared. Light squared.
We see it sure enough
see it sure
all
enough.
The time now.
All the time now.
All the time now.
Matter
sped up.
Sped up.
Sped up.
Becomes energy.
Becomes energy.
Becomes energy.
Matter and energy
matter
are essentially
energy
the same thing.
The same thing.
The same thing.
The same thing.
It's the same stuff,
the same
just moving
stuff,
at different speeds.
At different speeds.
Your thoughts are pieces of matter flying at the speed of light.
The speed of light.
Speed of light. Light is information.
Is information.
Is information.
Is information.
Matter is information.
Is information.
Is information.
Is information.
Is information.
Jen.
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 Everything.
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 Is information.
Is information.
Is information.
Is information.
I've finally broken through. Jen stops climbing. Everything is story. The theater. Lights are dimmed as we stand on the stage side by side. Jen sees the forms of the faces sitting in the balcony seats. They are you. Each seat spoken for by your imagination.
Miles was wrong. Or, rather, only half right. He said he was grabbing versions of you from various potentials. You know what those are.
What?
They're versions of you I decided against.
Huh?
This is a story, Jen. There is an audience. They care about you, too, by the way. Some of them immensely.
Jen stumbles on her thoughts.
When I decided to create the universe, I thought it into being. At first, the thought is foggy, but then I think about it more and the fog dissipates. It gains, let's say, dimensionality, form, substance. Sometimes, though, I have half thoughts, or I think this should happen, or that. And then I unthink it. I decide against it. That's what Miles tapped into.
Your unfinished works.
Precisely.
And there's versions of me in these foggy realms?
Yeah.
The classroom. I stand, leaning over my teacher's desk, towards Jen, going in for the final punch.
I think you're getting it now, no?
Every thought is an act of creation. I smile.
You and I both are, as you called me, gods.
My Jen drawing is locked in as Sisyphus?
Oh, I wouldn't worry about that. The drawing doesn't have a conscience. You didn't grant it that.
Oh.
Think on it. Love, justice, hope. I wanted that for this world.
And you failed.
Yeah. At least, in part, so far.
So, what do you want me to do about it? The courtroom. I, the judge, speak to the prosecution.
I said that Piper can't stand for everyone. I said you must stand for yourself. But now I'm relinquishing the masses to your persuasion. I'm handing over my power as creator to your judgment. You can choose. If you think the pain is too much, if you believe the journey's not worth the cost, then let Leviathan come. I will come in judgment. And everything on Earth will fall into Croatoan.
What about all those who have already died?
Past generations are already venerated. They've passed on.
Where are they now? The White Room. There's a magnificently vast white room. In it, bunches of souls meander back and forth.
Here they are,
I say.
It's sort of kind of like a purgatory, if you will.
Amongst the hordes, Jen spots Lilith Babbitt, dressed in white garments from head to toe. She doesn't smile. She doesn't frown. She meanders. She bumps into Jorge Robles. There, too, on the other side of the room, far away, but clearly visible, Red Jeb Heller. Jen throws a hand over her mouth. She never thought she'd see him again. But he's different. All in white. No frown or smile on his face. He's blank.
That's the problem. The fundamental problem, Jen. I can't create heaven.
Why not?
I don't know how to. I don't know how it would work.
Well, why not? Just make a happy place, a good place.
See, I tried. I took away all the bad. I stripped Babbitt's bad gunk out of her. I cleansed her. Made her white as snow, sinless. In a sense, perfect. Just as I made all these other characters who have passed through the veil of death. I took away their bad stuff. Left only the good. But without drama, without a storyline, they're all mute. In their hearts, as they walk, they're happy. Trust me, there's no tears, no tribulation in this place. But nothing ever happens. They just stand here or meander. There's no story.
What? The church. We're in the second pew, seated side by side. The church is empty besides us. I'm on my knees, hands cuffed. I stare up at a cross, my eyes pouring.
Croatoan is easy to know. It's the great nothingness. It's instantly and obviously understandable. It's a truth. We all can know it because we know there was history before we were born. We were all once a part of the nothingness, a part of Croatoan. But what is unclear, wretchedly unclear, is if there's something on the opposite end of the spectrum. If there's a Croatoan, an undoing of all things, is there a great doing? A great story where hate, injustice, and despair are nowhere to be found?
I don't know.
Of course you don't. Because I'm your god and I can't fathom it. But Jen, please.
I grab her hands.
I believe in the second life. I have to. I have to hold on to the conviction that there's another story yet to unfold. One that has love, justice, peace, mercy, goodness, all the way through it. There has to be a way for everything to end happily ever after. I believe in the second life, the one where all the pain is gone, but the one where there's still more to discover. There's gotta be more to goodness than boringness. You know we can't fathom that. That's why all the movies depict heaven as boring, with us all floating on clouds playing harps. We can't fathom the perfect story. We only know broken story.
Why is that?
Because my world, like yours, is broken bit by bit, end to end.
So why hope? Why believe that someone dreamed you up that's better than you? How do you know he's not just like you are? Right? Couldn't your creator just be like you the way my creator was you? How do you know he's not just another version of you with the same limits? The same inabilities?
I don't know. Not with certainty. But there's something, a small something, in all this. Isn't there?
What? What do you... What?
Pockets of beauty. Moments of grace. Mercy. Even though we're broken, we can still see it. If only for the smallest of fleeting moments. Beauty hidden in the dark.
The White Room.
This is purgatory now, but if I'm right, if grace falls from above, then it'll catch your universe too.
I don't follow.
When I meet my maker, I'll take you all with me, those of you who aren't Croatoaned. And then together, we'll discover happily ever after. We'll live eternal stories that move and vibrate. Everyone here, Red Jeb, Lilith, Little Robin and Tiff, you too, Jen, we'll find destiny, and we'll make more stories there. Stories without tears, Jen. We can't imagine it now, but we can imagine imagining it. Someday, I hope beyond hope that all my gunk will be torn away from me, and yet, I'll still be me. A new me. A me made new. But I'll look unlike what I tried to do with your universe. I won't turn into a storyless drone. I'll still have story in my heart. That's the vision, Jen. Can you see it? Dim though it may be.
The courtroom.
But you don't have to accept my hope beyond hope. You can choose for yourself. Let Leviathan come, or, if you'd like, I'll pull back the ladders. Let the world go on. Let love, justice, and hope continue to be perverted and abused. Hate, injustice, and despair. Things will only get worse.
What will happen to Atticus if I let Leviathan come?
Unless he climbs the ladder, he'll be lost.
Lost?
Eaten up. Erased. If he's on Earth when I fully awake, you'll lose him. All of him. Past and future.
That's dreadful.
But so was your life, no?
Jen's response is silence.
Your memories, experiences, everything you've shared with Atticus will be swallowed up. Unless he climbs, and unless she climbs, the same fate awaits Scout.
No.
If you stand on your principles, if you choose to not hope, if you reckon that I'm merely another evil cog in the fabric of life, then it's better to never be than to be.
What about me?
You, and, like I said, everyone who's passed through and entered my realm, can't be eaten up by Croatoan. There can be no more justice for you, Jen. Grace is just as unjust as false prosecution. Two equals on opposite sides of the same axis.
So, if I stop Leviathan...
They won't remember what happened. The numbered man's legacy will grow. Strange beliefs will dominate. People will follow new gods. Some, though, some of these people will be remembered. But eventually, most people will end up in Croatoan no matter what.
Because it stays broken.
Yes. But some will have a chance that they won't have otherwise.
So, Red Gem, he used to complain about his toilet.
Yeah?
It'd flush, but it'd take like all day for the toilet to refill with water. So, it was just running and running and running, he said. Made this horrible noise, loud noise. He said he couldn't sleep at night while it was going on, while the tank was slowly, slowly refilling. So, there were these series of letters from him for like 6 months, where he tried all sorts of things. He tried to fix it, tried duct tape, bricks, all sorts of things. He failed multiple times. He'd never do the logical thing, of course, and have someone fix it. No, he tried to work out a system, regulated himself, adapted, I guess you could say, so that he did all his toilet business first thing in the morning. He said he trained his body. At least, that's what he thought he was doing. But then, he couldn't sleep again, not because the toilet was running, but because he couldn't hold in all his stuff at night. His bladder squeezed and his body ached. Eventually, he wrote me and said that this was the best life lesson he could ever give me. He said, "The toilet will keep running no matter what. That's life." The Gladiator Arena. Jen stands in the middle of the arena, her sword outstretched. Its sharp point pokes narrowly at my chest. A small thrust and I'll be through.
Crowd's chanting, Jen. They want an answer. They need an end to this tale. What's it gonna be? Has it been worth it?
How do we end this? Perhaps like this. Let me present to you Jennifer Dash. Undeniably pretty. You'd like her immediately if you met her. And you have. Maybe when we're all made new, you will again. Afterword. Also, I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" Then I said, "Here I am, send me." And he said, "Go and tell this people, hear ye indeed, but understand not, and see ye indeed, but perceive not. Make the heart of this people fat, and make their ears heavy, and shut their eyes, lest they see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and convert, and be healed." Then said I, "Lord, how long?" And he answered, "Until the cities be wasted without inhabitant, and the houses without man, and the land be utterly desolate." Isaiah, chapter 6, verses 9 through 11. Alexandra Keitel Amaru's mission can still have meaning. She's preaching a simple gospel. The people have heard. You decide whether they are saved or not. Save them, one at a time. Go to dantestack.com/voices to find out the details and do your part. Not many of you will answer the call. Not many of them will be saved. Hey guys, all music and sound effects used in this episode and every other episode of Solve the World are on my show notes page at dantestack.com. Guys, in 2 weeks, if I get enough questions from you, I hope to do one last final special Q&A episode. One of those episodes that I like to call Solving the World. I'll only be posting it at dantestack.com, so check your local dantestack.com listings in a couple weeks. Feel free to send me questions. Please send me questions or I won't do this thing. Send the questions to me on our Facebook page, facebook.com/solvetheworldpodcast. Or send them to me at my Twitter handle, at Dante Stack, or send me an email. My email address is dantestack@gmail.com. I'm happy to try to answer some questions you might still have left over. Maybe this last episode wasn't quite clear, or maybe you have some other random questions you want to ask me. I'm here this one time to answer all those. It's been a great privilege to share this story with you. Peace be the journey. Sincerely, Dante Stack.